Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kalik, and this is Dispatches. As Israel's genocide in Gaza reaches new heights of cruelty, many are wondering why Western regimes, who claim to be the leaders of the free and civilized and lawful world, are enthusiastically supporting the belligerent annihilation of Gaza. Maybe it's their not-so-covert racism. Or perhaps it's opportunism in service to this or that lobbying group. Or maybe it's about what October 7th meant to the Western imperialist project. What Palestinians did in the Al-Aqsa flood operation seems to have struck fear into the hearts of Western leaders. They don't take kindly to indigenous people in the so-called jungle, as they use Joseph Burrell calls it, shooting at the garden. Could it be, then, that the collective West is backing the Gaza onslaught as part of a genocidal drive against the oppressed people of the global South? Sending a message that this is what happens if you dare strike back militarily against our rotten colonial capitalist system. Whatever the case may be, this is a mask-off moment for the imperialist West. All of the sociopathic narcissism that underpins the dystopian global order they created is on full display for everyone to see. They've made a mockery of international humanitarian law and killed any pretense of the freedom and democracy they claim to represent, as they turn inward to repress their own populations from dissenting against the shocking aggression on Gaza. To discuss this and more, I'm joined by Matteo Capasso, the Marie Curie Research Fellow at Columbia University and the University of Venice, Italy, author of Everyday Politics in the Libyan Arab Jamhuria, and editor of Middle East Critique. His work focuses on the nature and impact of U.S.-led imperialism. But before we jump into it, this is just the first half of this episode. The second half is available for Breakthrough News members only. You can become a member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. Matteo, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rania. Pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you on. And of course, you know, that the topic is an unfortunate one as we're watching this horrific genocide somehow continue to get worse in Gaza. We're recording this about a month after October 7th. So as of this recording, people in Gaza have been dealing with a carpet bombing campaign against civilians for the last 30 days. I'm sure that this number will be outdated once this episode goes up, because the numbers are getting higher each and every hour. But as of now, there's around almost 10,000 have been killed or known to be killed. And then about 4,000 children, more than 4,000 children, which is just a disgusting stain on humanity. But, you know, I'm really happy to be having this conversation to you, because I think it's about time we kind of contextualize what we're witnessing taking place on a global scale here when it comes to this genocide playing out in Gaza, Matteo. And, you know, the imperialist West, as we know, is backing this onslaught quite enthusiastically. And some people, such as yourself, have put it in the context of the global North living out a kind of genocidal fantasy against the global South through this aggression on Gaza. And I just want to read something that you tweeted. You said, "History is moving. The capitalist West is revealing all its genocidal drive toward the oppressed people of the South, and major powers of the world are watching." So let's start there. Can you elaborate on what you meant by that?
Yeah, thanks, Rania. It's definitely dark times in that we're living. So I would start probably by saying that what is happening in Palestine and even in Ukraine, you know, today cannot be understood outside of history. Both violence, non-violence, bombs and stones are never thrown outside of historical time. Now, history understood as a practical process, as material facts unfolding on the ground, not abstract categories that Western Marxists pick and choose, determine the dynamics we experience in the present. Basically, we cannot pretend that, as the ruling classes and politicians would like us to believe, that we live in a constant state of emergency, immersed in a present that has no relationship with the past and the future. So, while what happened in Palestine on October 7th must be understood in relation to the world, and when we look at the world, we look at a unit, It is also one of the most important parts of this unit because it unleashed a battle of immense magnitude that is leading to a reconfiguration of the unit as a whole. Now, a battle that is not simply a battle between Palestine and Israel, two state or one state. It is a battle that cumulatively is going to decide the future of humanity, that is testing humanity, is testing us every day because its future is at stake. And the future of what this unit, and again, by unit, I mean the world, is going to look like. This premise is so important because it is on the basis of this epic, historic battle taking place in Palestine right now that the entire world is witnessing an unprecedented campaign of genocidal killing, misinformation, and absolutely disregard of the people of the Global South. You see, it certainly takes a lot of ideological propaganda to hide one of the most glaring facts of Western civilization, which is the slaughter of the masses of the Global South always has been the prime industry of capitalists and Western civilization since the 14th century. Western values, but I mean the weight of ideas that define the social relationship instructing our geopolitical world, drip in blood and dirt. We Westerners love to fill our mouth with words like democracy, peace, international law. We do it and it is normal. But what is not normal is how we pretend that these values are simply the outcome of progress, peace, and benevolence. No, these values literally drip in blood. The genocide of the Americas, Congo, colonization of Africa and Asia, 20th century endless wars led by the US in the Arab region and beyond, Libya, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, decades and decades of international sanction and purposeful undermining of communist movements in Europe as well. All these are facts. They are not hyperbolic statements. These are facts that cumulatively allowed the American project to dominate the world. Now, what's important to understand is that stretching from the turn of the last century to the present, there has been a stimulus for Western imperialist wars in the era of finance capital, which has risen in tandem with the crisis of Western imperialism. There is a qualitative change with the American project under financial capital, and this has to do with the way it consumes man and nature in order to meet its profits. Karl Marx used to say that the principal contradiction of capital, by capital meaning the dominant relationship of society, was the capital-labor contradiction. Yet, this has further moved into a north-south divide. This means that every time contradictions emerge within the Western project led by the US, the resolution of these contradictions, meaning also the challenges to the primacy of the Western geopolitical power, will depend more and more on the degree to which imperialist countries oppress and exploit developing countries of the Global South. And so, in a historical moment, as we are talking now, where the US is declining due to the long march of China out of centuries of humiliation, and two special military operations of Russia, respectively in Syria and Ukraine, the West has been thrown into a geopolitical nightmare. What has the response been to this? A renewed wave of fascism and genocide, onslaught of the masses of the Global South, whose scale is directly proportional to the threat being posed to the Western project of control. Now, in this case, the role of historical agents having to strike a blow to one of the major cogs in the web of a declining American hegemony, meaning Zionism, have happened to be the Palestinians. But as I said, it is not only the liberation of Palestine that is at stake here, it is the future of the geopolitical order, of humanity as a whole. In the face of this huge blow, it is rather normal that the Western ruling classes have gone back to a core characteristic of their civilizational march, genocide with religious characteristics.
Wow, I mean, that's definitely a different way to look at it. And I want to touch on a point that you made, but maybe go a little bit deeper. And I know that Western leaders are quite racist. They're demonstrating that now with how they just don't care at all how many Palestinian babies are bombed. But still, I'm stunned every single day, Matteo, by the level of cruelty in their rhetoric. They seem just as invested as Israel is in crushing Gaza. You know, even this rhetoric about the civilized Israelis fighting off these like barbarians of darkness, Hamas. It's something Western leaders are invested in globally. You know, you can take that language and like a cookie cutter, place it in the, use it in this, it's been used, I should say, in every single situation where it's like the colonizers versus the indigenous people. It's always this, you know, the civilized, you know, light of nations against like these dark barbarians. And it's, you know, or you could say it's the garden versus the jungle, as the EU's Joseph Borrell puts it, right? Garden and jungle. And I would say like Hamas's October 7th operation was, you could see it as the jungle, the so-called jungle, fighting back against the garden. And that's terrifying, I think, to the West, you know, to the garden. And you can also see it in the way they're trying to repress their own populations domestically from showing solidarity with the supposed jungle in this case. And you've referred to their reactions as a huge wave of, and you mentioned it again now, but you've called it a huge wave of renewed fascism related to the capitalist West. And I'm going to, you know, note another tweet of yours. You said, if you are wondering what's happening in Gaza, step back and think that every single day that the genocidal instinct of the collective West carries on, we move closer and faster to the collapse of the U.S.-led international order. This is not wishful thinking. So when you talk about, you know, that, what I just said from your tweet, and also this kind of like renewed fascism, can you elaborate a bit on what you mean by that to kind of explain why this is happening?
So honestly, Rania, when you were talking about, when I think of myself as a, you know, as an academic somehow, as someone who grew up here in the West, I mean, I cannot reconcile with this unprecedented onslaught of people happening in Gaza. This fascism exists but must be located in history. Otherwise, again, it seems that events and trends emerge out of nowhere. What we are living, the history we are living, the facts, again, the facts as a practical process tell us that there has been a progressive economic crisis of China and two Russian military intervention, respectively against the US-led regime change against the Syrian government in 2015 and against NATO encroachment in Ukraine in 2022. And these events have decisively thrown the US and its allies, as I said, into a geopolitical nightmare. Now, the American project has entered an historical phase of political decline. The unipolar moment is crumbling, and new political blocs from the South are emerging, including the BRICS. They are becoming more assertive. They want to shape an international order that prevents their humiliation, but treats them equally. Together with this process, you know, when we think of the 7th of October, we also have to remember that recently we have witnessed a wave of military coup in West Africa against French Western neocolonialism, the increasing assertiveness of Iran in West Asia and its collaboration with Russia, while Cuba and Venezuela have withstood decades of sanctions and US-sponsored coups. The pressure on the West and its allies is increasing. And so why this is important? Because the most immediate reaction to the conscious realization of their decline has been a renewed wave of blatant fascist rhetoric and ideology and material actions. Now, there are certainly overlaps between fascism in the 1930s and what we have now, but fascism today is also the direct result of the failure of the liberal project. The Indian economist Utsan Prabhat Patnaik point out that this new fascism, what I call fascism with European characteristics, which is a direct pan, you know, for those who keep labeling China in all kinds of way, is based upon three major conditions that enabled its rise. First, there is a crisis, okay? This is a crisis and it has to do with the decline of US imperialism, which is now faced by the rise of the countries of the South, demanding to be treated equally in the world. Second, the Western ruling class incapacity to overcome or unwillingness to overcome this crisis, since it would mean accepting them as equal actors. And third, the complete state of disarray of the left in Europe. The latter is what I personally consider the most critical aspect. So starting with 2016, with the election of Donald Trump in the US, the most striking feature of this newly fascist West has been the complete rehabilitation of Nazism, for example, in Ukraine, as a form of popular resistance against dictatorial Russia. Now, from Giorgia Meloni in Italy, where I am, to Macron in France, I'm not even touching on Germany because, you know, it's a desperate case. The European ruling classes, they are ready to sacrifice everything, their people, their countries, for the mighty power of the US. So again, this is not a question of, oh, look, that political party has won the election. This is a historical tide of Western fascism in which we are drowning right now.
Well, that sounds incredibly frightening when you put it that way. I think another part of this that should be emphasized is, you know, people are, of course, horrified by Israel's brutality, specifically in the case of Gaza. Right. And something interesting about this time around, because there's been many onslaughts on Gaza, though this is the most aggressive I think we've ever witnessed, we do see the term genocide being used in the mainstream. But actually, you know, the genocidal intent, you and I both know, has always been there. Why do you think it's so much more, though, obvious today when it comes to the way Zionism is acting out against Palestinians? And I think that that does build upon what you're saying in many ways.
Yes, because this renewed wave of fascism in the West has also struck its most faithful allies in the region. And when we look at the case of Israel, I would say there are probably two major issues to highlight. First, Israel, as you were saying, vis-a-vis the Palestinians, has always been a racist project. The state of what is known as Israel is based on ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians and the forceful displacement of more than a half of the Arab population of Palestine in 1948. Now, there are videos which keep circulating online, and I'm sure you've seen them too, where retired Israeli generals admit to all kinds of unspeakable crimes committed by Zionist gangs. Factually committed, I have to say, not fabricated, as we have seen now in the recent weeks when discussing the Palestinians. Such as raping of women, mass graves, to the point that there is an academic article where two Israeli academics document how the Zionist army poisoned the cistern water of the Palestinians in order to kill them. Basically, what we are seeing is that there is nothing more reassuring than having the chance to admit these crimes, yet being completely sure that nothing will happen to you. We did this, we are sorry, maybe, but you know, this is history now for them. But let's keep going. In the aftermath of the first Intifada in the 1990s, an Israeli colonel accused of ordering soldiers to break up the limbs of Palestinians testified that these beatings were part of the accepted norm in that period. Testifying in his own defense, this colonel called Yehuda Meir told three military judges that his superiors did never question this order. There was nothing special in it, nothing out of the ordinary. Actually accused Jack Rabin, the so-called engineer of peace with the Palestinians, to be the one who ordered the military to break bones and legs of Palestinians. When these charges were raised, what did the Israeli parliament do? Decides not to investigate Rabin. What I'm basically saying is that to show that, yes, Zionism has always been racist. And we can go on and on about this, Rania. We never lack the evidence and facts. It is always the political clout that did not allow the space to talk about them. Yet, there is a second important point which relates to what you were talking about, why this is more obvious now, why it is so blunt, much more in your face, fascist and reactionary in nature of the Israeli government today. In the past years, what we have witnessed is the increasing authoritarian consolidation to power of Benjamin Netanyahu and the emergence of fascist leaders within the Likud party ranks, Naftali Bennett, Lieberman, and so on. Israel in 2018 had the opportunity to legalize officially the exclusive Jewish nature of its state, which basically ratified further the Israeli citizenship law of 1952. Now, there is also the crisis of the so-called Israeli liberals, and we will talk about this further even when it comes to the West, which is reflected by the increasing power of the Haredim, the Orthodox community in Israel, whose views have now been magnetized by circus workers, because that's what they are, like Itamar Ben-Gvir. They represent 15% of the Israeli population with very high birth rates. At the same time, the Haredim population, since the early 2010, represented 30% of those living in the settlements of the West Bank. So, as the Israeli government was failing to provide housing to these communities, he lumped them in occupied land. Now, all these factors is what ushered the crisis around this very debated Supreme Court reform in Israel, which the Haredim supported. And the reform was basically saying, we want to allow the Israeli parliament to overturn the decisions of the Supreme Court. This has created major protests in Israel. We should always remember that none of this reform, none of them have any impact over the lives of the Palestinians. Neither this protest ever questioned the legality, not the legality, the existence of the occupation in the West Bank or the 16 years blockade imposed on Gaza.
And then, I mean, there is the fact that, you know, we know the U.S. supports Israel for a lot of reasons, but I think the primary reason is U.S. imperialism. But can you unpack that? What does that mean? Why is Israel so central to the U.S. imperial project?
So I think that this is really, I want to thank you for this question, because I think each, at this historical moment, each and every human being who is looking at Gaza must be able to answer this question in order to develop a clear understanding and a principled political position, not over, Palestine, but over the future of humanity. The American project, what we call imperialism, is a system of worldwide control. It's based on material exploitation of the South by countries of the North, which also includes the collaboration of the ruling segments of the South of the world. This material relation of exploitation and domination is maintained through the use of military domination, sanctions, and whatnot, in order to basically prevent developing countries from harnessing their internal resources for regional or popular development. Together with the material component, there is an ideological war unleashed on these countries, which can include the use of gender ideology, developmental discourse, and all these kinds of human rights discourse. In other words, the project of US-led Western domination is material, economic, military, political, and ideological. Now, for this project to consolidate, each continent and region of the world has undergone certain changes. In Europe, what we have seen, which we discussed, me and you, in previous episodes as well, was the use of the strategy of tension and the funding of Nazi forces to counter anything that resembled or was supporting communism. In the Arab region now, in the Arab region, the situation developed differently, yet as part of this unit. The Arab region, in fact, occupied a unique role in the geostrategy of U.S. imperialism since World War II, especially due to its oil wealth. Being a key natural resource for the economies of the imperialist countries, the best means to ensure their guaranteed access consisted in controlling politically the region. To achieve these goals now, the American project operated in close cooperation with two faithful social political formation allies, Israel and the Gulf monarchies. And this is where we get to the relationship between imperialism and Zionism, between the US and Israel. As per the Zionist entity, this became effectively a US military outpost in the region. Now, between 1943 and 2023, a recent US congressional paper, which is available online, shows that the US has provided Israel with $160 billion US dollars in aid, with inflation adjusted reaching about $260 billion, without considering the regular loan guarantees extended that are worth billions and the military packages. Obama, for instance, the so-called most progressive president of the US, who deliberately bombed Syria and Libya, provided Israel with $38 billion in military assistance, the largest aid package in U.S. history. Ideologically, it is fundamental to highlight that both Israel and the U.S. share a political mythology of exceptionalism. This political mythology basically incarnates the colonial and missionary zeal that justified the genocide of the Americas back in the days, and displayed the religious belief towards the idea that, you know, the U.S. has a unique role to play. The same goes for Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians and the region. After all, how many times did Netanyahu show up with a new map of the Middle East at the UN? So, as much as ideological reasons are important, we always need to figure out the material premises of this relationship. Why does the U.S. invest so much in Israel? Why does the U.S. provide Israeli with so much money to have free healthcare while this money is not used to provide jobs and healthcare to Americans? And the same goes for all Western governments. This aid, all this money to Israel, is an investment in militarism, in war. Now, there is a peculiarity of the Zionist entity which lies in being a settler colonial formation like the U.S. that incubates a mode of consciousness that promotes Western values while securing U.S. domination of the region. When Israel acquired nuclear weapons through its numerous military attacks on other countries of the region, we're talking about Egypt, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Israel has been the major force behind imperialist capital control and accumulation, and its corollary, meaning Arab regional development. So, as the Palestinian leftist circles in the 70s and 60s consistently told us, Zionism is the spearhead of imperialism. So, as much as the liberation of Palestine is a struggle against US-led imperialism, on whose behalf Israel acts as a policeman, an attack on Israel is an attempt to undermine directly the core interests of the US and its allies in the region. And it is so important to understand this passage, because all of a sudden, what do you realize? That the Palestinians are not fighting the Jewish people. This is far from reality. The Palestinians, as per history's mandate, are facing a structure, an imperialist web in which Zionism represents a fundamental cog.
I mean, yeah, I'm so glad you explained it like that. And then you can understand even better when there's that clip of Joe Biden from like the 1980s where he explicitly says, were there not an Israel, the United States of America would have to invent an Israel, because it does serve that very purpose that you just explained.
It is the best $3 billion investment we make. Were there not an Israel, the United States of America would have to invent an Israel to protect her interest in the region. The United States would have to go out and invent an Israel.
But then let's move to the Palestinians and then other groups in the region that we, you know, that are referred to as the resistance, right? Groups like Hamas, the rest of the Palestinian factions as well, Islamic Jihad, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and on and on and on. There's military wings for each of these political organizations that are currently involved in the fighting in Gaza. Hamas's Qassam Brigades happen to be the largest of those factions. Then you also have Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is a very powerful force. And of course, their partner, Iran, which is an actual country. You have the Houthis in Yemen. You have the various factions in Iraq. They've all been smeared by the U.S. as terrorists. In fact, these groups are labeled by the U.S. as terrorist groups. Iran's IRGC has had the terrorist label slapped on it as well. But in the region, they're known as the resistance axis, and they're seen by many people. I won't say everyone, obviously, because the region is very polarized internally as well. But by many people, they're seen as forces of anti-imperialism. And some, you know, in progressive circles in the West might find that a bit confusing because a lot of these groups have a very religious flavor. So, Matteo, can you explain to our audience how these groups serve as anti-imperialist forces in the Middle East, both ideologically and materially? And that's not to like endorse anything. It's just to state what I think is an observable fact.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I'm glad you said that at the end, because we always need to start from facts, which is something that the Western Marxists don't do. So from history, Once we look at history as a practical process built on facts, on material facts, rather than abstractions of a book club called Western Marxism, on which I will comment later, then we can understand what is happening here. The struggle of the Palestinian resistance is a struggle for national liberation. And at this historical moment, Hamas is leading up the struggle. Though, as much as the Western media loves to single out Hamas, we are, as you rightly said, we have different political factions. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, coordinating their political and military actions with Hamas. This historical process is not coming out of nowhere. Now, I'm going to keep banging on this, but 2011 witnessed the success of the NATO-led regime operation in Libya, but Russia's intervention in Syria showed that regional and geopolitical balances were about to change. Second, the capacity of the Islamic Republic of Iran to withstand decades of sanctions, like Cuba or Venezuela have done, has allowed it to grow into an important political player, becoming what we could say, for sure, the number one enemy of Israel. Providing support, Iran, to other socio-political formations in the region, including, as you said, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Ansar Allah in Yemen, and the Islamic resistance in Iraq, the political and military assertiveness of Iran represents a decisive shift in the nature of the ideological march of the region against the American project. What is important to understand is how the Mukawama, the resistance axis, consolidated, becoming what we can definitely call an anti-imperialist force in the region. Why? First, on an ideological level, Iran and Hezbollah have largely avoided producing a sectarian, exclusionary, Shia-led vision of the region, despite what the mainstream analysts in Washington, D.C. they want to tell us. Mm-hmm. In other words, they circumvented the danger of responding with the same medicine to what U.S. imperialism had progressively funded since the times of the Afghani Mujahideen, working hand-in-hand with Sunni reactionary forces. The Wahhabi vision of Sunni Islam, basically, which we saw what it did in Syria, in Libya, and in other places. On the contrary, the Mukawama, the resistance, has organically preserved the historical and ideological continuity of the region, moving from Arab to Muslim unity. It did not reject the past, you know. It has instead combined past and present, creating a new ideological order that calls on Arab Islamic identity of the region to fight against the material and ideological war unleashed by foreign oppressors, U.S. imperialism. Now, the religious call, from a Marxist perspective, is a powerful one to mobilize the masses. And it is completely in tune with the ways in which the American project, as we were talking about, has turned religion into the major syntax to express political grievances in the region. Mm. Politically, the Axis has also emerged as the only political force coherently articulating a fight against U.S. imperialism. The other forces, secular and non, were in fact either attacked by imperialist wars of aggression or turned into useful collaborator of imperialism. Let's look at Fatah and the PLO. So for the so-called Western leftists, and now, you know, this is important to say, all this process is utterly irreconcilable because Western Marxism has been so infiltrated by the US and its ideological weight, let's think about Gladio again, that literally has turned into a book club, a bourgeois project detached from the material struggle of the masses of the South. They enjoy theorizing about Marxism with their imperialist privileges. As a result, what did we see from Western Marxists? They've all come out comparing the fascist government of Netanyahu to the Islamic fundamentalism of the Palestinian resistance. Some of them, they even went as far as to say that they are two sides of the same coin, or Netanyahu created a Hamas. Again, these are wild abstractions that have nothing to do with the practical process of history. Western leftists go around with what? With a checklist, Tanya, hoping to find what? The secular, gender-sensitive, non-violent resistant movement, very often NGO-funded. Yet the so-called Western Marxists are the same one that weaponized the language of human rights to allow a US-led regime change against the Iranian government, or were very happy to turn the most reactionary US-funded Sunni groups, Islamist groups, into some sort of moderate rebels. when undermining the sovereignty of Syria and Libya in 2011. Mm. Now, on this point, I think it is important also to look back and realize that why everyone jumped on the so-called Arab Spring in 2011. Because the Arab Spring was a protest movement that largely diluted the imperialist question in the region, diluted the Palestinian question and the fight against the American project in the region. The Arab Spring looked like more an inspired Obama version of, you know, of the region, as he also famously proclaimed at the time. Hezbollah at the time was perceived as a political actor suppressing protest in Syria, siding with the regime, a sort of political force in a sectarian region. October 7th, however, flipped this equation and it reignited the centrality of the struggle for Palestine against imperialism and Zionism in the region. Now, whereas the Egyptian government is letting people in and out of the Rafah crossing in Gaza, according to Israeli whims, the Egyptian streets are chanting for Hassan Nasrallah to intervene in the war. This is a major shift in the region that threatens the stability of the ruling classes of the Arab regimes.
You know, it's interesting you put it that way, because I was thinking in recent days how there are people who I know personally, I haven't polled people, but I do know people personally who after 2019 in Lebanon, you know, there was like an uprising in Lebanon that I wrote quite a bit about. It was very quickly and sadly hijacked by various like NGOs and embassies and just groups that were trying to mold it into like an anti-resistance movement, yeah. Which, yeah. And some people did become anti-resistance. And I think it's because either there hadn't been a war with Israel in what seemed like so long, right? And it seemed like that wasn't the big threat anymore. And now it was about, you know, changing Lebanon internally, domestically, not understanding that imperialism remains the primary contradiction. And, you know, you can't fix Lebanon until it's a sovereign country, and it can't be a sovereign country until it doesn't have the American, Israeli, Saudi boots on its necks, right? But I've seen some of those people now go back to, okay, we get it, pro-resistance. And I think that's interesting because it's like, all of that 2019 funding, not all of it, but a significant portion of it seems to have been undone by this war in Gaza. And so it kind of speaks to what you're talking about, where this genocide in Gaza is like reorienting the region after all of these imperialist efforts at distraction and, you know, fomenting sectarianism. And I'm not saying this is undone all of that. Obviously, those cracks still exist. But it is, I mean, seeing those images out of Egypt's Tahrir Square with people calling on Nasrallah to bomb Tel Aviv. I mean, if you had told me that was going to happen in Egypt this year, there's no way I would have believed you before October 7th. You know, that said, I wanted to speak about another angle here. And that is, you know, yes, it's devastating to watch Israel carpet bomb babies. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. They're carpet bombing babies. They've turned Gaza into a death camp. And they are committing, they're saying it. They're saying they're committing a genocide. The Israeli officials, at this point, we have plenty of evidence. If Israeli officials are ever prosecuted in a court of law, it would not be difficult to prosecute them for carrying out a genocide in Gaza, because they've said so many times that that is what they're aiming to do. Yeah. But you know what? Dropping bombs on babies, Mateo, is actually not difficult, especially when you're Israel and you can get away with whatever you want. It's the easiest thing to do when you have superior military power to drop hellfire missiles and bunker buster bombs on residential buildings and hospitals and refugee camps on people who can't fight back. But, you know, militarily, if we you know, look at this just from pure military terms, the Israelis haven't really made any military advances. Yes. Hamas is still firing rockets. And we see videos they're releasing showing them quite bravely, I would say, taking on the Israelis who are, you know, operating under the cover of tanks. Like you see Hamas guys completely, like, you know, not wearing any armor, walking up to tanks and putting explosives on them and then like walking away. And that's how they're fighting the Israelis right now, on the ground, blowing up their tanks. Meanwhile, in the north of, you know, historic Palestine, what the world internationally refers to as Israel, Israel's playing by Hezbollah's rules. Yes. It seems the Israelis are showing that they're, you know, as Nasrallah called them back in 2000, weaker than a spider web. I mean, even with the most technologically advanced weapons, from the U.S. at their disposal. It seems like they have an infinite amount sometimes, that we know there is a limit, because, you know, they could actually end up using all of them and not have very much left at some point if this continues. It seems all the Israelis excel at is killing civilians. I'm curious your thoughts on the military side of things and the significance of the fact that the Israelis have set this goal for themselves of eradicating Hamas, which we all know is just not possible.
Yeah, first, I think, Rania, probably 2 points, I mean, or three. I would say that the first thing is we have to remind ourselves that Israel is fighting the war, but the U.S. and Europe are administering the war. And this is something that Hassan Nasrallah reaffirmed in his speech very well. There is an umbilical cord between imperialism and Zionism. So when we refer to Israel, as you rightly said, we refer to U.S.-made planes, bombs, generals, and troops participating, actually, being there. You know, we've seen all these reservists that they've come. So the Palestinians in Gaza are facing a world structure, not an army. At the same time, what the U.S. and Israel are discovering, though, is that it doesn't matter how much you can kill if you don't know how to fight. The imperialists have set up very unreachable objectives, eliminating Hamas completely. Yet, what they really don't understand is that you can kill as much as you want, but you cannot eliminate the idea of national liberation for the occupied people. The only way to reduce the power of Hamas is to reduce the condition under which the Palestinians' resistance emerges, thus the occupation, the creation of a Palestinian state, and so on. The Americans and the Israelis, you know, when I was thinking about, they operate exactly the same way the technocrats operate when they say we are facing an economic crisis. They tell us what? That all we need is a technical solution. Cut budgets, print more money, raise interest rates, eliminate Hamas. But they always avoid the root causes of the problem. Profit, greed, capitalism, Israeli occupation. The difference here is that the entire Western world has turned genocide into a technicality. So they are just genociding an entire population. As you said, you know, 4,000, half of them is kids. They launched a silent ground invasion with a complete censorship on what is happening inside Gaza. But what did they achieve? Nothing. They have shown the complete unreliability of the West. They vaporize the pretense, whatever pretense Western values still have. And the more they continue to do so, the more resistance will emerge in the region and beyond. And as a second point, Rania, because I think this is very important, we need to remember one thing. There is no way to defeat a people's war. There is no way. We have seen this over and over throughout history. We have seen all the videos of these fighters, as you were saying, in track pants, assaulting a Merkava tanks, costing $4.5 million with bare hands. The resistance has a capacity, as a strategic and tactical capacity that goes way beyond the Americans. And that's what Hezbollah is also showing in the north, because it basically has entered the world, is imposing its tempo, it's not rushing, and they have responded it in clear and important targets.
Well, and then I want to also move to, with that in mind, the fact that we finally heard from the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, a few days ago. It was, I think, maybe like 26 or 27 days after October 7th, he gave his first speech, and it was much anticipated by everybody, people in Lebanon, people in the region, the Israelis, the Americans listened very closely. And, you know, Nasrallah, he laid out the narrative as the resistance sees it. He reestablished the rules of engagement with Israel on Lebanon's border, and explained what Hezbollah was accomplishing with the sort of, you know, border war that's been taking place since October 8th. And he, of course, demanded, I mean, one of the central points he made was that we need an immediate ceasefire. But he also laid out, you know, some red lines for Israel and the West. And he, you know, proclaimed that we have a willingness to go to war with you if you really want to take it there. We don't want to, but we will fight. We will fight you, especially if you dare come after Lebanon. So I'm curious, Matteo, I'm sure you, I know you listened to the speech as well and watched the speech as all of us did. What are your thoughts on that speech, which I think, you know, was a very sober, calculated, and strategic when compared to the kind of emotional insanity of the leaders in the global north, and especially of Israeli leaders who are just like on a bloodlust vengeance warpath?
Absolutely, yeah. I think the speech of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was carefully threaded, you know, laid out. And I was stuck. I mean, there are many points, you know, we can, I mean, even the same fact, which I'm sure you listened to, Rania, that Western diplomats were, they sent questions to the Lebanese, to the Hezbollah, to ask, to Hezbollah, the representative, to ask for clarifications about some of the passages, shows the, you know, the fear that Hezbollah is, it has, you know, the power, not the fear, the power that Hezbollah has right now over in the imperialist and also over the over Israel. But said that anyway, I think there are probably a couple of points that that really struck me, and I think they are worth you know, raising. The first one is probably the centrality of patience and steadfastness, which is Nasrallah and the resistance is dictating the tempo of the war, and is not willing to engage in a war according to Israel and the US genocidal killing. It cannot and will not do it. And I think this is very important. Why? Because they are showing that they operate against imperialist time. They are informed by what we do, could call a temporality that is completely at odds with the one in which the Zionists and imperialists operate. So to be clear, the resistance forces have made out of patience the key team and weapon. One has to think about the time taken to prepare this operation on October 7 and the capacity to surprise the most technologically advanced army of the world. They work through steadfastness, they learn from battles, they have built a long political horizon of victory, which again has been cumulative, starting from the war in Lebanon between Israel and Hezbollah in 2006. So they have a deep sense of time, which aligns with the history, with the rise of multipolar order. The Western forces, on the other hand, they are so trapped into this reactionary mode of violence, of genocide, they just want to reestablish the status quo as soon as possible. And I think this is one of the most important aspects for me. But there is another two aspects which are interrelated. And again, I'm sorry to repeat this, it's really a blow to whatever Western Marxism is being left here, because the speech of Sayyid Ed, it was anti-imperialist in its nature. Why? Because Nasrallah discussed Palestine as an independent battle, yet central to the region and the world order. In fact, he not only highlighted how the resistance axis did not know anything about the operation, but they at the same time, they are working and entering the war according to the tempo of the battle in Gaza, which is the most important battlefield. So Palestine is central, yet independent at the same time. Also, he stressed that Palestine is a question of national security, not just for Lebanon, for Egypt, for Jordan. Basically, Palestine is not a Palestinian question only, which is precisely what every collaborator of imperialism tried, you know, would love Palestine to be reduced to, into an NGO single issue problem. What Nasrallah said, and he spoke as one of the leader of the resistance axis, showed this great temperament also when, you know, talking about the possibility of Israel and the US infringing the national security of Lebanon. And the last point is that, and I think this is where really show the analytical capacities, not of Nasrallah, but of this of history, of the resistance itself, that it connected all this to what? He didn't bother to talk to the Israeli government. He spoke directly to those administering the war, the US government. And no matter, I think, what checklist proposed by Western leftists to identify the progressive movements, we really are able to see the anti-imperialist consciousness of Hezbollah and of the Mukawami. It's right in front of our eyes. These are facts, they're not abstractions.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear the rest, you can access it by becoming a Breakthrough News member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews.